Conversation with Keith Runyon. We are at the Courier Journal offices on Broadway in Louisville, Kentucky. It is July 19th, 2001. My name is Ethel White. If we could start with some biographical information on you so that we know who we're talking to.
I was born in Louisville, Kentucky at the Old Deaconess Hospital, which was, I believe, at 8th and what is now Muhammad Ali. I'm not positive of that address, but I believe that's correct. Can you hear me?
Mm-hmm.
On October 3rd, 1950, I was born at a time when Louisville remained largely segregated. My first home was on Fairlawn Road in St. Matthews near Seneca Park. My grandparents lived across the street. And recently, my aunt, who was my grandparents' daughter and my mother's sister, provided me a copy of the deed to their house at 507 Fairlawn Road in what was known then as Lexington Manor, which contained restrictive covenants requiring that the property be sold only to people of the Christian religion and of the white race. I think that it's most fitting that part of the time my grandparents' great-grandchildren lived there who are biracial. Of course, the neighborhood's long been integrated, but my cousin, my first cousin's daughter has biracial children, and of course that's the way the world is going, and happily so now. But it was a very segregated town. And for a child growing up in what was the, you know, reasonably affluent East End of Louisville, the impressions of integration were vivid, and there are landmarks in my childhood and early adult years that affected me deeply. And the fact that we lived in what we thought was a progressive city in the Upper South didn't shield us from a lot of the ugly realities of what happened all over America, but particularly below the Mason-Dixon line before the 1960s and 70s.
Okay. Do you have any, let's say, up till the age of about 18, going off to college, are there any particular memories that border on this subject?
Oh, yes.
Can you go through them? Take your time?
Oddly enough, one of the early areas of memory I have focuses on entertainment. We had, of course, primitive television in those days. I'm young enough to not remember the arrival of television in our home, although it occurred sometime after I was born, but not long afterward. And my father was with GE most of my childhood, so we always had state-of-the-art televisions. But I can remember being shown, for example, the Nat King Cole show, which was fairly controversial in the 50s, early 50s, I think, maybe 53, 54. And Nat King Cole and other jazz artists were particular favorites of my parents. My mother's a pianist, and she loved to play jazz, even in the 50s, and they would go to performances of people like Billy Eckstein, who was a famous jazz pianist. And I remember when they would come home from events like that, they made just comments about being among the only white people in the audience. That was not a typical experience. My memory of going to the movies and going to other kinds of performances when I was probably up to about the age of 10, if I think hard, I realize those were all white audiences in the theaters on 4th Street. I'm told that black people were allowed to sit in the balconies, but for whatever reason, I don't remember that. I just remember that in 1961, we went to see, I'll never forget the film, it was 101 Dalmatians, the Disney film. I was about 10. And we came home from the theater, and my mother just commented on my father, not disapprovingly, not approvingly, just as a matter of fact, that there was a black woman sitting behind her in the theater. This was at the what we called then the United Artists. It's now the Louisville Palace Theater. And that would have been in early 1961. So that was a landmark I remember. I remember going to the old Fountain Ferry Amusement Park, which was an annual expedition that we would make in the summertime, sometimes with my cousins, sometimes in church groups. But as you probably know, Fountain Ferry became a flashpoint for integration in the late 60s. And at that time, even though it was what was becoming increasingly the predominantly African-American part of town, only white people were allowed to go there. And I think the thing that makes me saddest, one of the things that makes me saddest about this aspect of my childhood is that in those early days I was completely ignorant of all of this. It wasn't an issue of whether we were making a right or wrong choice. It wasn't even an issue. And yet I was surrounded by black people at various points of my childhood and accepted them as being just the same as white people. And I think...
In what capacity are you going to get to that?
I'll get to that.
Okay.
But at various levels. But the point was that when I was very small, just the specter of integration was not one, or of segregation was not one that I was really aware of. And I'll tell you when I began to be aware of it. One of the first occasions was when I was 7 or 8, maybe 9 years old, with my mother and grandmother and brother, probably, in the old basement coffee shop of Stewart's department store. And subsequently in the Orchid Room, which was the more expensive ladies, in those days sort of ladies restaurant on the top, up on the fifth or sixth floor, and it was right outside the where they sold china and crystal and things like that. It was very elegant and a kind of world that just no longer exists in terms of eating in department stores. But we would go downtown to the doctor or to the dentist and do some shopping and usually go to lunch at Stewart's, sometimes at the Blue Boar, which was also segregated. But at Stewart's, what I remember were the there was a line that would form outside the coffee shop, and they didn't do reservations, they would just take your number and you'd have to stand and wait, and sometimes it could be a long wait. So we were always glad to sit down, and usually we had packages that we could put on the floor and you felt relaxed to do that. And I remember one day seeing a group of extremely well-dressed African-American women standing there and clearly not being served. What I really remember is when they sat down on the floor. And these were women who were every bit as well-dressed and well-coiffed and everything else as my mother and grandmother, and there was absolutely no reason that they would be given any different treatment except they were black. And I was outraged by this, and my mother and grandmother explained this to me, and I remember that youthful sense of rage that you would feel when you saw rank injustice. And I think some of the seeds of whatever I did later in life were sown at that particular lunch table. Other times I felt that same rebellion on car trips through the South. My aunt and uncle for a time lived in Mobile, Alabama, and we made several long car trips back in the days before air conditioning in the 50s in a, I guess it was a Plymouth station wagon. The drive through Alabama seemed endless. It was before I-65 existed, so you had to drive on these two-lane roads. And I was very small, 6 or 7, so the towns mean nothing to me anymore. But what lingers in my memory are the segregated drinking fountains and restrooms, and get this, Coke machines. Why on earth it would make any difference for a black person to buy a Coke from the same machine as a white person, I have no idea. I have no logical explanation for it, but I remember they were there, and I remember that I was determined to get a drink out of either the soft drink machine or the soda fountain. And my parents, who had no prejudice against me doing that, were scared to death because they thought it would start some sort of racial trouble. And at that point, things were beginning to happen. This was 57, perhaps. So things were beginning to happen, particularly in Montgomery and so forth. And so I think they had, and I probably had a bit of a mouth and would have said something to someone. So I can remember sort of being herded into the car and told I couldn't do that. I also remember on a trip to the South sometime in that period going to a brand new railroad station, I think in Mobile, Alabama. This was not one of the 19th century Gothic places like we had here or Nashville did, but this was brand new, state-of-the-art, with air conditioning and everything else. And there were identical white and, as they called them, colored waiting rooms, which made no sense. And I just wanted, I remember my uncle, who was an executive with the LNN down there, was taking us around to see the station. And I saw that black waiting room and just had this passion to go inside. And once again, it was just, oh no, you can't do that. We won't do that. But all that lingered. I remember going to New Orleans in 57 or 58, and again in 1960, and being vividly aware there of segregation. The signs were everywhere, white and colored. I remember by 1960, I was starting to read newspapers, and they had the colored obituaries in the paper, and they had colored news, and they had, or Negro, they may have called it, I don't know. And I remember in New Orleans, for some reason, they printed their newspapers on green paper in those days. That may have been one edition that had late stocks or something, but I can remember those newspapers with the news about, quote, colored people on this green paper, and in my young mind, I thought this was the most bizarre thing. It was like being in a, you know, in another world. It didn't make any sense. I don't remember Brown versus Board. That was before my memories really came into focus. But I do remember seeing Martin Luther King Jr. on the Phyllis Knight Show. Phyllis Knight is a local news person. She had one of the first TV interview shows. It was called Small Talk. It was quite good. It was on WHAS. I think it won some Peabody Awards and things like that. But she had all the newsmakers who came to town appear. Usually it was around dinner time, and I can remember my parents telling me about this really important young black leader, Martin Luther King, and we sat down and listened to him. And that stayed with me. I can't remember anyone else she had on that show during those years, but I do remember seeing Martin Luther King there. I also remember the television coverage of the Little Rock school case and the National Guard, and particularly watching President Eisenhower's speech. My family was Republican, but they were of the liberal Republican ilk, as was often the case in Kentucky, particularly in those days. People who liked John Sherman Cooper, who liked Thurston Moorton, those two senators were very supportive of civil rights. And I remember President Eisenhower also had the reputation for being good on civil rights, and mind you, Kentucky had been a Democratic state in part because the Democrats went along with Jim Crow for so long. So there was a time before Barry Goldwater led the party down a completely different path when the Republicans were different, and that was the heritage I came out of. So we sat down and watched President Eisenhower, and there was no question in our home that he was doing the right thing, that it was terrible that these children would be not denied the right to go to school. And there was also, I think, a real sense of how brave it was for them to do that. But as far as I know, I had yet to attend any classes with African-American children by that point. The Louisville schools were integrated in 1956, but we lived in St. Matthews, and I attended Great House Elementary School. And I'm sure, knowing now what I do about the busing case and the history of the county schools, that there was, it was just a decision made at the highest levels to draw the districts in such a way that you would have white children going to most of the schools and black children going to Newburgh. So I remember no black children at Great House. We left after I was in third grade and lived in Knoxville for a year, which was more segregated than Louisville. This was in 1959. An interesting story about Knoxville that I remember, we had never seen the television program Amos and Andy, because here in Louisville, for whatever problems we had, that was one show that the local television stations wouldn't carry it here. The NAACP didn't approve of it. A lot of markets didn't carry it. I believe, I may be wrong, it was either the Nortons or the Binghams who had the option of carrying it, but one of those families, probably the Binghams, but I'm not positive, elected not to carry Amos and Andy. But in Knoxville, it was not only carried, it was on every day, along with Tarzan movies, which I'd never seen before either, and they had, you know, these incredible jungle scenes that were actors who had come out of vaudeville, mostly running around in loincloths. And so these entertainment images made a big impression on me. I remember about 10 years later, Bill Cosby did a really terrific special for CBS. I think it was, I forgot what it was called now, but it was so good. And he just dealt with the images of blacks not only in movies, but in documentaries and newsreels and so forth. And a lot of those images that I'd picked up, particularly in Knoxville, that had been shielded from the people here more, I think, they were memorable, and in retrospect, they were rather, you know, they were significantly alarming. And I don't understand the ongoing fascination with all of that. I am a collector of old movies and some old TV shows, and the catalogs are just filled with Amos and Andy. And I, a couple of times my children have listened to, my son, who's 13 now, went through a period of loving old radio. And he and his best friend David Weiss would listen to these shows. And David's father, Maury, who's a doctor here in town and a little bit older than I am, was also a big fan of old radio. But he also had these sensitivities, and we had to explain to the boys about these things, just as we did about the Tarzan pictures. Try to help them to understand them in a cultural sense. We came back to Louisville in 1960 after a year in Knoxville, and we moved out to an area that was just being developed as subdivisions off Taylorsville Road, sort of between, I guess it was beyond Hikes Point, but before you get to Jeffersontown. And in those days, it was the Hurstburn area, too. And it was the old Bullitt Farm, which was being developed as subdivisions. And I went to Alex R. Kennedy School for 3 years, 2.5 years, which was also one of the first schools to have advanced program. And that was another reason why I went there. And I remember that that there were two African-American kids in the class for the first time sitting in the room with them. One of them was especially bright. His name was Henry Toogood. I'd love to know. I haven't heard of him in years, but he was in the advanced program and he's a great guy with a wonderful sense of humor. And I look back now and realize that that was so important for me to be around kids who were my peers at a time. This was in 1960, 61, 62, when the television was becoming more and more filled with the images of the protests in the South. But my principal exposure to African Americans up to that time had been with people who worked for us. My father grew up in Fisherville, which is a small, semi-rural community between Jeffersontown and Taylorsville. And all his family came from Oldham County. And they lived out in the country, and they had they lived a much more integrated life than anybody in the city did. But people had their roles, and we had, he had growing, his mother died when he was 10, and he was raised in large part by an African-American woman and her husband, who worked for my grandfather, their names were Willie and Jake. And Willie, when I was a small child, came to work for us, and then later her daughter, Anna Mae, worked for us. They're all gone now, unfortunately. But in the way that I was raised, I wasn't aware of racial differences between us. But I did, you know, there was this innate sense that these people are here and they're working for us, even though I was, you know, we were taught not to, there was never any question that that they worked for us as children, but you know, there was a distinction there. And then my parents had various people work for them over the years. One in particular who still works for my parents and is still a close friend. She took care of my grandmother when she was elderly. She takes care of my mother and father and my aunt. When my cousins and I married, I think she may have been the first person we told, maybe even before our parents. It is something out of another time. And it's something that occurred in this city. And I'm not here to offer apologies or justifications. I'm just here to report that it did exist and that our lives were enriched. The woman who's worked for my parents for a long time, her son went on to become a top officer of the Louisville Fire Department. Another son became the head waiter at the Jefferson Club and went on to do his own catering business. You know, they've been to college, they've been military officers. It was a world that was not available to their parents. It was a world that was not available to their grandparents. It is a world that I am thrilled to be a part of. And it's one of the reasons why I am so committed to a lot of these issues, because there was no reason for them to have any experience in life different from mine. It was just a matter of circumstance at birth. I would like to talk, last two events of my childhood that I would like to discuss are the Republican Convention of 1964 in the Cal Palace in San Francisco, and then the election campaign that followed. Sometime in the period of 1963 to 64, I became just galvanized about politics and public life. The Kennedy assassination occurred. I was just deeply affected by that. Barry Goldwater seemed to be this creature from another planet when he ran for president. I was only 13 at the time the primaries began, but I was very much connected with public events and reading the newspapers here in Louisville, the Courier, Journal, and Times, which I'm sure affected my view of the world. And I was also watching a lot of television news, which in those days really, in some ways, did a much better job, I think, covering issues. And they were less interested in instant sound bites and instant cam reactions, and more interested in filming things. For example, Edward R. Murrow would do these marvelous documentaries on things like migrant workers or I can't think of any other right now. That's one that really sticks with me. But I watched all of those as a young person coming along, and we had that locally because WHAS and WABE were among the top broadcast stations in the country. And they would do documentaries about issues like civil rights. And I can remember the open housing marches in, I guess, 63 or 64, when Ned Breathitt was governor in Frankfort, maybe Burt Combs at the end of his term. But, you know, it was just everywhere around us, and it was popping all the time. And it was, and here in Washington, our senators, John Sherman Cooper and Thurston Moorton, seemed to be on the side of right with Lincoln and with the Kennedys and with Hubert Humphrey and Paul Douglas of Illinois and all these wonderful, Leverett Saltonstall, who was a Republican from Massachusetts, they all were right on this issue. Senator Keating of New York, who was later defeated by Bobby Kennedy, and Senator Javits. And all of these were sort of the people that I admired growing up. Margaret Chase Smith from Maine. All of these people were strong supporters of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. And when Barry Goldwater voted against it, that for me was one of the great moments in my formative years. And that was when I decided, first of all, that the Republicans are not for me. If they are embracing him as a leader, then it's time for me to look elsewhere. But beyond that, it was a sign to me that people either were on board or they weren't. And I think time has proved that we were right about that. And today you can't find anybody who opposed the Civil Rights Act. Everybody was for it. But that's not the case at all. I can remember my friends in school talking about it, using the N-word. And, you know, these were kids who probably their parents would have washed their mouths out with soap if they had heard them say it, but they still did it. And by this point, I was going to Seneca, to junior high school, and Seneca was very integrated. We had a lot of kids from Newburgh, but Seneca was also segregated because we had tracking, as the schools still do. So I was in the more advanced classes, and we once again sort of had fewer and fewer African Americans. I think Henry from Kennedy School was still there with us. So we were in these sort of white clusters within the school that was much more diverse. But Wesley Unseld, for example, was there and was on the basketball team. Diane Sawyer, Jerry Abramson. It was quite a school in those days. And quite a lot of stuff was popping. And that summer, Barry Goldwater voted against the Civil Rights Act, and I can still remember the Courier's coverage of it, reading it over July 4th weekend, and Hugh Haney had the most wonderful cartoon that I clipped then and still have somewhere, but I also have a better copy now that I've worked with Hugh, and it had Kennedy and Lincoln in the clouds, and they're peering down from the clouds with huge smiles on their faces, and Lincoln is saying, "Look, Jack, they passed it." And it was just a really great cartoon. And to me, Barry Goldwater and the people who agreed with him, Strom Thurmond and all the Southerners, really, even Senator Fulbright, who in other ways became a hero, were the villains in this. So they went on to San Francisco to the Cow Palace, and that was the other really vivid memory I have, staying up late into the night, watching the television coverage of the Republican convention, and seeing the civil rights platforms being not just voted down on the floor of the convention, the Goldwater controlled, but the speakers being booed from the platform. Speakers like Senator Morton of Kentucky, Governor Rockefeller of New York, Senator Romney of Michigan. So that was something you just never forget. There was something very eerie about it and scary. So those are the main memories of my childhood. I was a freshman in college. No, I was a senior in high school when Dr. King was shot in Memphis. And Bobby Kennedy was shot on the day I graduated from high school. I had worked on his campaign in Indiana, where we were living then. I lived in Evansville, and I met, or you know, it was this huge crowd of people that met Bobby Kennedy in Evansville in 1968. But all of that stayed with me, and I was just then getting into journalism. I had worked on the school paper in Lexington, where we lived for a time. We moved a lot when I was growing up. And then in Evansville, I got my first job on a daily newspaper, editing a teen page that came out once a week, and I would go down to the Evansville Courier and work with a staff of reporters around the city who would give me things to put into the paper. And then there was a college girl who worked with me to help me put this together every week, but it was a great experience. And each week, we would do a survey of kids, ask them a question in the news. What did they feel about Vietnam, which was then, of course, very big, or the draft? Did they think that Bobby Kennedy should run for president? And I remember we had a question about Dr. King and the assassination. And by that point, disagreement about civil rights was becoming less and less. I mean, it still went on. And that was the year that Strom Thurmond switched to the Republican Party, or around that period. But it was becoming less and less acceptable, especially among younger people my age, to express views that were not pretty supportive of what was going on.
Let me just ask you, it seems that the connection between your, you know, political interests and going into journalism is obvious. On the other hand, is there any other comment that you wanted to make on that?
Well, I could have gone either way. I was also very interested in law, and saw law as being, I think for somebody with a sort of activist bent, there may be three courses. There's law, there's politics, and there's journalism. And I'm an introvert by nature, so politics was never even a possibility for me. Although I was I was just so deeply affected by the Kennedy assassination, the second one, that there was a time when I thought, well, you know, everybody wants to be in the Senate. Everybody wants to run for president. Everybody wants to pick up this torch. But I knew that that wasn't for me. I ended up actually going to law school and practicing at the Courier Journal as an in-house counsel for the Binghams for a time. But really, I think I saw, even in law school, that my real gifts were in writing and observing and in using whatever skills I had as a lawyer to serve that purpose. So it all fit nicely together for me, and I found a way to sort of bring all my interests together and to keep going. You know, I started at the Courier Journal in July 1969, which, to give you a little context, was the month that man landed on the moon. It was the week that Judy Garland died and that Stonewall occurred in New York. It was the month that Teddy Kennedy had his accident with Mary Jo Kopechne. It truly seems like another world right now. Henry Cabot Lodge was in Paris trying to negotiate peace with the North Vietnamese. When I started here, Earl Warren was retiring as Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. Barry Bingham Sr. was still the publisher of the Courier-Journal. Mark Etheridge had retired, but Norman Isaacs was the executive editor, and Barry Bingham Jr. at that point was working mostly at WHAS and was an associate publisher here, but had a much lower profile. So when I came to work here, it was just a very different time, and it was a very exciting time. This was considered at that point certainly one of the 10 best papers in America. The Time poll that was done every 10 years placed us third in 1973, when I'd been here 5 or 6 years, right behind the Washington Post and the New York Times. So we felt that we were doing something very special here, and particularly to be in this particular part of the country at that particular time, because the Courier-Journal, for all of its faults, and we had many, many faults when it came to race and to gender issues, but it still had what was, by almost all accounts, the most glorious liberal editorial page in the South, with only one or two possible contenders in Nashville at the Tennessee and Atlanta and the Constitution, Journal and Constitution. But, you know, in those days it was a pretty barren field out there. And even Miami and some of the other places that have, Charlotte, that have become better papers in more recent times weren't very good back then. And of course, most everything was family owned, so you had a lot of these sort of southern bourbons who owned their newspapers. Another good example of an exception is Anniston, Alabama, oddly enough, which was owned by the, is still owned by the Ayers family. Randy Ayers is the publisher there, and he has been, as the Binghams were in Louisville, a great force for positive change in a town that is pretty reactionary. Anyway, I came back from Evansville, where I had, fortunately, I another thing that happened to me growing up was that I lived in so many of the Courier-Journal's outlying areas. I lived in Evansville, which was southern Indiana, and we had circulation all the way over there when I was growing, starting here, and all through western Kentucky. I lived in Lexington, which was, of course, right in the Bluegrass, and learned all about that area when I lived there. And then I spent much of my youth and childhood in Louisville. Louisville was always the place I wanted to live. I had opportunities to live other places, including New York and Washington, but I don't know, there was something about this city that always resonated for me, and there seemed to be a lot to be done. And it's a city that seems to me is manageable in size, so you can get things done. You can observe significant change, and I have in the time that I've been here. When I came to work in the Courier-Journal newsroom in July 1969, there were no African-American professionals on the Courier staff, with the exception, I believe, of one photographer and one copy editor who worked nights. The Times had several reporters, including Clarence Matthews, who of course went on to a distinguished career here and wrote a column for the Times and is still active in many areas. Interesting story, Charlene Hunter Gault, who went on to fame with PBS, had her first newspaper job as an intern on the Louisville Times. And George Gill, who was publisher here in the 80s and early 90s, recalls when he was a young reporter going with Charlene Hunter Gault and other people out to Blackacre, the Macaulay Smith farm, and feeling comfortable being out there swimming together. But the public swimming pools in Louisville were segregated when she was working here in 1960 or 61. And of course, the private pools were all, in those days, were all segregated too. Then the, but the Courier's reporter, who still is here and is one of my best friends in the world, Merv Aubuspin. He became a reporter really by accident. He was an artist who worked in our art department, extremely talented painter and graphic artist. He taught at Central High School and had gone to the Tuskegee Institute in the days when public education in the South was segregated. He came from Louisiana originally. After Dr. King died and the West End of Louisville erupted in turbulence in mid-1968, which was before I came here, there were no black reporters on the Courier-Journal. They sent all these white reporters down there, and the leaders of the demonstrations refused to speak to them. So George Gill, who was the city editor, and Norman Isaacs, who was the executive editor, and I can't remember who the managing editor would have been at that point. Sorry. But it was shortly before George became the managing editor. But they decided, we've got to do something. What are we going to do? So they went into the art department where Merv worked. Merv at that point was, I don't know, in his early 30s, and said, you've got to help us. We need somebody who they trust. We need somebody we trust. Will you go and report for us? And he'd never reported before. So he did. And he did a fabulous job. One of the indignities of it, though, if you go back and read the clippings, other people got the bylines and Merv did the reporting. And he'd come back in. That wasn't atypical in those days. That happened at a lot of papers. You'd have police reporters who would then be rewritten by rewrite people. And sometimes no one would get a byline. Sometimes the rewrite person would. But rarely did the real reporter. So I don't think that they viewed it as a real racial put-down, but today we look back at that and think, you know, here this man was venturing into harm's way and he didn't even get any credit for it. Merv was especially good because earlier in his day, he had been involved in a lot of sit-ins and demonstrations here in Louisville and knew everybody, still does. He went on to become associate editor of the newspapers, the first president of the National Association of Black Journalists, leader in the American Society of Newspaper Editors, and a very, you know, important figure nationally, not just here. But after that experience, they decided we've got to really focus on this because we've got this issue that's important to us, and we can't keep sending white people to cover all of this stuff. So the first thing they did was to send Merv to Columbia, and he got his master's degree in journalism. And then they started other efforts to draft African-American reporters for the staff. I remember one in particular, a man named Joe Broadus, no relation to the mayor Broadus here in Louisville, but Joe was from, well, his mother lived in Florida. I don't know whether Joe grew up there, I can't remember now, but he was fresh out of college, extremely shy, tall, gentle, and experienced some of the most appalling indignities I can imagine. We had reporters at our cop shop, as we called it, down at the police station, who freely used the words nigger and coon and every other pejorative you could think of. And we never saw them. They were just voices at the other end of the telephone. Well, Joe didn't sound, I mean, I don't.
Joe was an African-American. Okay.
Joe Broadus did not have an accent any more than I did, probably less than I did. So he would start rattling off their racist stuff to him. He put the phone down one day, and at first he was stunned. This would have been about in the summer of 1970. Then he walked out into the hall and started to cry. And I went out, and we talked, and I said, well, they don't even know you're black. I should call them up and tell them. He said, don't tell them. That's the worst thing. I don't want that to happen. I want to know what they're really like. And so that was important insight for me. He and I became good friends, and actually we traveled together. This was a fascinating story. In 1970, summer of 70, 72 was the first, no, 73. It was the first summer I worked here full-time. In 70, well, I mean, on the reporting staff. I had been a summer intern in 72, and I worked as a clerk and an obit writer in the previous summers. One summer went to school in England.
So when you came in July of 1969, these were summer jobs?
No, it was year-round, but I wrote obituaries and did the weather report and wrote a column on military awards in Vietnam. Then I went to school at U of L during the day, did this at night.
Okay. Part-time then.
But I've been here, except for the summer of 71, which I spent in England as a student. I've been here straight through ever since. 73, Joe and I took a trip with another friend who had been an intern with me, had just graduated from Michigan State, through the South in a car that I had bought just a few weeks before, a Datsun 510, little cute little car. I don't think it ever occurred to me that people might think it was odd that two white guys and a black guy would be traveling together to the South. But we really did turn some heads, I think. We spent, what I really remember was going, Joe's mother and grandmother lived in outside of Miami. He was working at, he had left the Courier at that point, was working at the Herald. And we stayed there at his mother's house, and then we decided I was a big Hemingway fan, so we wanted to go down to Key West and see the Hemingway house and so on. So we all piled in my car and drove down to Key West. And we stayed at a hotel there and went to the beach, and I can remember that people literally got up and moved away from us at the beach. This was in 1973, so, you know, seems like not that long ago, really, but... And we had a similar experience at Fort Lauderdale, and we also went to the beach further north somewhere. I can't remember where it was, but I do remember the beach in particular, and I don't know what it is about swimming pools or water or whatever with African Americans, but there was a real racial edge about all that. Maybe it had to, water is the stuff of life. Maybe it had something to do with drinking fountains and Coke machines as well. I don't know. I've sort of digressed here, but the point is to say that this liberal newspaper, which was espousing civil rights on its editorial page, and certainly through the cartoons of Hugh Haney, which were incredibly powerful, and whose publisher was getting calls in the middle of the night threatening his children and calling him a communist because he supported these things, basically still had a fairly lily-white operation. The big push to integrate the staff would come in the 70s and early 80s. And the person who really was responsible, two people who were responsible for that more than any other, were both white. One was a woman and one was a man. The woman was Carol Sutton, who started here as a secretary, because in those days, women in the 50s, women had a hard time getting jobs as reporters, and she was desperate to work here because she was a crusading young liberal who'd been in the Stevenson campaign and wanted to work at the Courier Journal. And she could only get a job as the secretary to the executive editor. Well, they saw right away that she was talented, and she moved up in the company and was made features editor in the early 60s. In those days it was the women's department, but she changed all that. By the time I started on her staff in the summer of 72, it was called Today's Living, and it was in many ways the most dynamic part of the paper, or one of the most dynamic. And she, and I'll show you some of those stories in a minute, but she really had a determination to push the envelope with readers. And then she had, in 1974, in part because of that, she was made managing editor and was the first woman to be a managing editor of a major American newspaper. The other person that I give most credit for this is Barry Bingham Jr., who in every way, as I saw it, as a news executive and as publisher, was consistent. There were inconsistencies in other people here, but the way that Barry articulated policy on the page was the way that he articulated personnel policy within the newspaper. He put Carol and Merv later to work recruiting all over the country. We developed programs not just to recruit trained people, but to identify children practically who were in the Louisville school system who could be guided. We called them cherubs, and they were guided to summer programs at Northwestern, on to college. We'd follow them through college. I'm sure that much of their education was paid for by the newspaper at different times, although many of them didn't need that. But the point was that it wasn't accidental. One of the things that I learned here was that important change in society is rarely accidental. It occurs through disappointment, through planning, through patience, and through determination. And let me give you a good example of one of those cherubs. His name is Michelle Marriott. You'll see his byline on the front page of the New York Times quite frequently. He's one of the top reporters at the Times. He was developed by the Courier-Journal when he was a boy going to high school, junior high school here in Louisville. Another person that has just flourished beyond anyone's wildest dreams is a young man named Everett Mitchell, who was a fledgling reporter here in the late 70s, early 80s, a little later than that. He's now the publisher of the Wilmington newspaper, and his boss, Vice President Gannett, is a man named W. Curtis Riddle, who started on the Courier-Journal as a reporter, fresh out of Southern Illinois University in 1971 or 72, around the time that I started on the city desk. Curtis is now Senior Vice President Gannett, one of my bosses. He worked for a time on the editorial page here. I would say that he was not appreciated in Louisville as much as he obviously was by Gannett. The business is full of people who came through the Louisville newspapers, and many of them got their first chances here. I'd like to talk a little bit about, one more thing about Carol. She was put in charge of minority recruitment, and Barry didn't want, he wasn't satisfied with having 5 or 8%. He wanted the professional minority employment to equal the city's minority population, and there was a period when that was true. It's not true entirely now. And of course, the argument that's always used is that, good people go elsewhere, and we're glad to have them here, and then we're glad to see them go on to the Post or the Times. But it's still a challenge for us. It's great. Our executive editor is African American. And race is really not an issue anymore in promotion and so forth. We have alumni who are all over the country in executive positions who are women and African Americans. But I've been here long enough to remember when it wasn't normal, and it wasn't even normal here. So that's been a great change. Coverage was so important because in the early days of my career here in the 70s, Louisville readers exercised bigotry through reading the newspaper and reacting to it. They still do, but they're much more sophisticated than they used to be. I can remember, for example, when I wrote this story in 1973 on biracial adoption. And this appeared in April 1st, 1973, 3 days before the 74 was the 20th, the year before. Anyway, this was considered unusual enough that we devoted a whole page to it. I remember the day after this appeared, opening my mail, and I guess the man had gone out and mailed it on Sunday downtown so it would get to me on Monday morning, and he had scrawled in ugly writing all over every picture the N-word, another racial epithets for these beautiful babies. Every time a black person's picture would appear in the paper, unless it was a crime story, people liked this person. And this man in particular always horrified me because he was a retired executive of the L&N Railroad and lived on a very exclusive street in Louisville. And, you know, that envelope would arrive and Carol would say, "Oh my God, it's Mr. So-and-so," and I won't name him. And so we knew what was in the envelopes, but I always thought it was my duty to look at those, even though some people threw away hate letters and so on. But for me, and I keep things like that in my drawer as a reminder of what we're dealing with here, that so many racial issues now are glossed over, so many of the things that we've gone through in fairly recent history are forgotten. I think it's important to be aware of that legacy that is still out there. A follow-up on all that, just within the last 10 years since I've been editing the forum page, 10 or 15, I remember when we began using photographs of our columnists, and there was a reason for that. In part, we wanted to show readers that we were presenting a diverse point of view on the forum page. A lot of women, a lot of African Americans. One day, for example, we had, and I made the choices, not based on a quota system of, well, we have to have one woman and one African-American, one conservative, but just what to me seemed the best that day. And it so happened that I think three or four of the stories were African-American and maybe one woman. But there was no George Will on that page or David Broder. And I got several phone calls. "Will you stop putting all those N's on the forum page?" And people hear that and they can't imagine that readers would do that, but they do. And we still get letters like that. Betty Baye gets some of the most vicious, vulgar, subhuman letters I've ever seen. And I get some about her. And I keep some of those in my drawer too, because I think they're very important for us to be aware of. And Betty has helped teach me that, because if you know where you've come from, then it helps keep you on track to where you're going. When we did these stories, you have to realize that in those days, women's pages, which is what this had been, had largely been debutante parties and engagements and stories about cooking and parties and so forth. And Carol Sutton, with the support of Barry Bingham Sr. and then Jr., who were publishers during that period, and George Gill, who was the managing editor, Bob Clark, who was the executive editor, all believed this was very important work to do. And it dovetailed so nicely with the news coverage of civil rights and women's rights, and with the editorial page, too. So we kept going, and I did a lot of the early reporting on abortion when it was still illegal, and there was a doctor in northern Kentucky who did abortions in an airplane as he circled the Cincinnati airport, and that way he evaded the law. That was the month that Roe v. Wade came down. Here is, we did a lot on educational programs in the especially the old Louisville school system was very innovative for a time under Newman Walker, who was the superintendent, and then under Milburn Maupin, who was the first African-American superintendent. And programs like Follow Through and Head Start were ones that we particularly paid attention to. We paid attention to federal programs for school lunches. We monitored those to make sure that the kids were getting not only adequate food, but were getting good food, and a lot of times they weren't. So we would do stories on some of the scandals in the cafeteria. We did stories on, there were these wonderful schools, you may remember, called Focus Impact Schools. Theodore Roosevelt School in Portland was one of them. The old Belknap School was another. Newman Walker hired this cadre of really bright educators who came into Louisville, and we spent a lot of time covering them, and I believe that that coverage helped set the stage for what later emerged as a sort of platform for the busing struggle, because conservative people didn't like, I don't care what they said about modern education techniques or whatever, but I think that a lot of it boiled down to race. I think it still boils down to race. Today they may talk about civility or they may talk about manners, but a lot of it is still race. And back then it was much more vivid because people were more straightforward about it, but they viewed the city school system as being this liberal place that mollycoddled young kids and basically was the white kids in the suburbs were moving through the county school system and that they were doing a better job in their view. And so you had this clash building. And interestingly enough, I think it really came to a head during the Nixon years when the grants began to be cut off by the federal government, although Nixon was far better than Reagan or his successor. But the Southern strategy and all the effort to kind of put the brakes on the liberal movement in the early part of the in the Johnson years and so on, the brakes were really on in those days. And we sensed it here because the grants would start to dry up. So the programs that were going on that were really making a difference in children's lives were in jeopardy, not because they were not producing results, but because the grants were drying up. And the same thing applied in healthcare, in mental health care. And generally speaking, the people who benefited most from the grants were the disadvantaged, and in a city like Louisville, many of them were African Americans. So the rhetoric about big government, the rhetoric about federal grants, the rhetoric about welfare was also rhetoric about race, and it still is in my view.
Can we, I'm afraid you're going to run out on me, so I want to.
15 minutes.
I want to be sure we cover the busing from 1975, unless there's something that we've.
No, I think I've probably blathered on too much here. Busing was like the Goldwater episode, sort of a pivotal thing for me in my professional career for a couple of reasons. One, it came at a time when a lot of uncertainty was going on in the community and the world, and I was 25, 24. We'd gone through Watergate, we'd gone through Vietnam. Vietnam was just winding to a close. Nixon had resigned. We'd gone through a lot of upheaval in the cities in the late 60s. So much change in such a short period of time. The women's movement was just charging ahead. And then in the mid-70s, this lawsuit was filed by the NAACP and others in Louisville calling for integration of the Jefferson County school system. And a similar suit was filed for integration of the old city system, because Atherton and some of the East End schools were predominantly white. And of course, busing was a big tool in those days to try to achieve more desegregation and also to improve the lot of everyone. It had its detractors, but the Courier-Journal, on its editorial page, strongly advocated busing as a tool, not the only tool, to remedy segregation and the vestiges of a period when segregation was not just a social pattern, but was the law of the land. So it's our feeling, and it still is, that using the tools of the government to remedy what government had once inflicted upon people was entirely in order. So with that as background, we strongly supported the lawsuit. People like Lyman Johnson were the plaintiffs. They were some of the best educated, classically educated people I ever encountered in my career, people who could sit and quote stories in Greek and Latin, and whose experience was wide, and who also had this very real sense of urgency about the time. It wasn't something that we could wait 2 or 3 years to remedy. It had to be done now. And as the case moved along in the courts, I don't think people in Louisville realized how much the urgency was there. I don't think the community had a sense that this was upon it. It was almost like a tornado, which in that same period, Louisville had this devastating tornado in spring of 74, which these two events sort of come together in my mind because of the sheer force, the community-wide impact, and the way that people reacted. In the case of the tornado, I think they reacted beautifully right away. In the case of busing, I think it took a little time, but ultimately, I think people reacted, except for a small and very vocal minority, reacted very well also. Judge Gordon issued his first ruling about this time of year, late July, mid-July, 1975, and I was, at that time, a city desk reporter covering higher education and mostly the University of Louisville, and also general assignment, and I was on late rewrite 2 nights a week covering just whatever came up, still going to fires and so forth, and just getting this broad street experience that's so important if you're going to have a career in journalism. And the night that Judge Gordon called the reporters into his chambers to issue the ruling, I was working late rewrite, so I was sent over with Ken Loomis, who was our federal courts reporter and later became a colleague on the editorial page, and he's now retired, and with Dick Caucus, who's still a reporter here, a very fine reporter, trying to think of some of the other people. Some of the editors went over because it was such a historic moment, and everybody sat in that room, and Judge Gordon passed out the order, and I was there to help write about it. And it was unclear specifically what my assignment was. It was unclear what some of the other people's assignments were, but it was clear that at the end of the evening we were going to have comprehensive coverage. And so I remember making a lot of notes, and mostly I did what Merv did earlier on, and that was to augment other people who had specialties. For example, Linda Stahl, who covered education for us, might have needed some additional people interviewed, so I would go over and interview them, and I'd give her information, or I'd give talk to some of the lawyers and give that to Ken. I was very young. I mean, I guess I hadn't turned 25 yet, so when I think back on that, I realize that that was awfully young to have this much responsibility. But it was a pivotal experience for me, and so I then just after that night found myself.
Was it pivotal because so much responsibility was on you, or was there some other aspect of it.
No, I think it was even more, well, for a couple of reasons. First of all, I think that, certainly. I think because it was such a big national story. I think because it involved, for me, I had been flirting with the idea of going to law school, and even had been admitted to law school at UK after I finished college and decided, was offered a job here and decided to stay here instead of going on to law school. But doing that work with the case reignited my interest in the law. And so I think that it had a lot to do with my decision ultimately to go to law school. And finally, and this is a really selfish thing that evolved that fall, but I decided I did not want to be, that I hated what I saw about the community, and I wanted to do something that was more than simply reporting to advocate change. And I think it pushed me toward the editorial department. And within 2 years, I was working on the editorial page when I hadn't yet turned 27. And I'd started already to begin to talk to people like Van Cabot, who was then just becoming the editor of the Times page, and was such a dynamic Southern liberal, and just a great force for me in terms of believing, A, that a 26-year-old kid could write editorials, but also that he could go to law school and hold his own with all these people. And so for all those reasons, I think being involved in this particular story had an importance for me. Plus, I hated the bigotry I saw on the streets. I hated the fact that people in our community were being tear gassed. I hated seeing the ugliness, and I also felt sorry for the people who were being so ugly, because a lot of them were, I think, basically products of sheltered and ignorant experiences. I don't think those people would be out today. Probably a lot of those people have children who are married to African Americans now, or have themselves. You know, it's just the world has changed so much.
Did you cover any of the street stuff?
Oh yeah, and.
Maybe you haven't finished with court yet. But.
Well, really, I have. okay. But we covered everything intensely. And mind you, we had competing papers in those days, the Times in the evening and the Courier in the morning. So we were always, and the Times had this really fabulous reporting staff. Ed Bennett, Judy Rosenfield, Linda Raymond, people who were really good at this. And in some ways, on the feature level, better than we were. But we did things very aggressively. In those days, nobody worried about overtime. You know, you stayed and you did your story. And later on, the labor people came down on the newspaper and said, you've got to pay these people something for staying and working these long hours. But I was probably making, at that point, $12,000 a year. And I would work 60 hours a week. And we'd just stay and have a great time and get as much as we could. One of the things I remember doing was when the bus routes came out, we just all came to the office on Sunday and we worked getting them set in type, proofreading them, sitting around, and we did that together as Courier and Times. It's the only part of this that I think we did as a team, but I can remember that spirit that transcended the competition, that we wanted children to know, to have the security of knowing where they would go to catch the bus. And it was not just a job, but it became a community effort. It was our way of helping this community obey the law. And that was the bottom line for us. No matter what the criticism was, the newspaper stood for obeying the law. And the law of the land said that we were going to follow this desegregation order, and the newspaper, by God, was going to do everything it could to educate the public to do it in a peaceful and reasonable way. In fact, the vast majority of Jefferson County did do it in a peaceful way. The vast majority of Jefferson County, if not enthusiastically, certainly embraced it. And that embrace became so clear that by 1991, when the school board decided to change the plan substantially, there was this hue and cry from people in all parts of town saying, don't take away our school system, don't take away integration, this is good, this has been good for our community. And we've seen it in our housing patterns, we've seen it in all levels of our society. So, but there were some who didn't agree. And I still believe that a lot of that was fostered by economic displacement, which was occurring at the same time. The federal government, well, we had a big recession in 74 and 75. A lot of it was triggered by, I think, the uncertainty over Watergate. The Arab oil embargo occurred in, what, late 73, I guess. Oil prices went up. We had rampant inflation. Home mortgages, interest rates were just going way up, and it was harder and harder for people to own homes. And then there were big layoffs in 74 and 75. So a lot of people who had good factory jobs and so forth found themselves out of work, with time on their hands, in homes that they might barely be able to afford, and they were watching these photographs of African-American children getting on the bus and coming into the schools and the neighborhoods that they lived in. And the fact is that many of these same people had grown up in the neighborhoods where the African-American kids were then living and had moved away in the white flight that occurred here in the suburbs in the 50s and 60s. So what I saw, I think, was as much, especially among the lower middle class whites, was an economic resentment. And the blacks became the target for that. But I think it was more than racism. There was plenty of racism, sure. And there's no question about that. But I think it was more complex. And I think that there was a lot of outside, I don't like the term outside agitators because I feel like George Wallace when I say that, but it was in reverse. Boston had gone through a tremendous period of busing in the year just before we did. In fact, our editors went up to Boston to meet with the people at the Globe to talk about how they had covered it so we could copy some of that and also not make some of the same mistakes they had made. But a lot of the people who came in were from out of town. The Ku Klux Klan, without question, was a big factor. The John Birch Society. All of these far-right groups that were really popping to the surface and had not found a national administration to embrace them the way they have today. They were, I mean, Gerald Ford had very little to do with the far right. That came with Reagan and even more with Bush and with Dole and now with young Bush. But I believe that that Louisville, despite the awful things we saw in the fall of 75 and again in 76, behaved in a relatively law-abiding and admirable way on busing. And we could talk all day on less admirable qualities about Louisville when it comes to race, and there are many of them. But by and large, Louisville people followed the law and they integrated their schools, and they produced now what I think is the school systems here have evolved into national models in some ways. We have outstanding opportunities and they cross the racial lines. Now they aren't, there still are problems, the tracking is a problem, the magnet schools aren't as well integrated as they should be. But the change has been so great, and I think it all, for me, came together last year when the Central High School parents sued to reintegrate, or to resegregate, essentially, Central High School, and to put aside the busing order, which was still in place, and they found themselves on essentially the same side as the people who'd been segregationists in the 70s, and I thought that was a great irony. For different reasons, surely, but nevertheless, it occurred. There's this odd nostalgia for those segregated schools, and I understand a lot of that in that you had this really excellent level of teaching there, people who were overqualified because they couldn't get jobs in many other places, so they were teaching in segregated colleges and high schools. But the school systems did not allocate resources fairly. Lab equipment in the predominantly black schools was just grossly inferior. Textbooks were ancient. Facilities were dirty and were not kept up in the way that the
the more affluent white schools were. And we operated a really discriminatory dual system in those days, and I don't think we do that so much anymore.
I know your time's about up,
yep.
But can I ask you one last question before we go? What do you remember about any staff meetings, decision-making about how to cover these events, what to cover? Does anything stick out about any of that?
Well, the most important staff meetings were, after the editors went to Boston, they came back and issued a memo about it, as I recall. And I don't remember major staff meetings, but what I remember was the level of TLC that reporters got in the newsroom. And that stayed with me over the years. And my wife is involved in environmental work, and a lot of times she has to deal with hostile situations, as you understand, you've done that too. It's very important, if you go out into the community and face hostile people, to come back home to the office and feel nurtured. And what I remember would be one night, the first weekend of busing, I was out in Fern Creek covering a demonstration, and I was phoning into the office information for the big story. And somebody threw a brick, a piece of concrete block or something, at the phone booth, and it became dislodged from the mounting. This was long before cell phones, so we had to depend on pay phones, and we were like, you know, the light would come, you'd shut the door and the light would come on, and it was sort of like saying, oh, well, here's somebody from the Courier-Journal, let's have target practice. So I can remember really being really scared, and the editor, and I can't remember who it was now, it probably was Elmer Hall, who was the city editor at the time, just a terrific, old-fashioned, hard-nosed, excellent editor, said, just go slowly. Just tell me what's happening. Don't pay attention to those people out there. You're all right. Just don't worry about it.
This was when you were in the phone booth.
I was in the phone booth, yeah. And fortunately, the line wasn't cut. The same night, I was tear-gassed, and I remember the police chief, Russ McDaniel, taking me into the trailer to help me, because my face was just, it was like, you know, skin crawls from the tear gas, and he helped me with that. And you know, the Courier and the police at times have been at odds, but I always had great affection for him, just for showing this kid into the place and helping me get some treatment. Danger was there. I the night before the order went into effect, before the first day of school, a bunch of us were sent out to the fairgrounds to cover an anti-busing rally, and there were Klans people there and so on. And in those days, I was very thin. And those were also days when everybody practically at the newspaper still wore suits, didn't go out in a knit shirt or khaki pants the way everybody does now. So I was in a three-piece suit at this rally on a hot September night, and I can remember somebody trying to sort of rough me up while I was taking notes. And I'll never forget Bob Hill, the Times columnist, was then a pretty new reporter on the Times. I was on the Courier, so we were sort of the enemy. But I can remember him grabbing that person and just sort of pulling him off of me and picking me up and taking me by his side. Bob's about 6'8 or something, and former basketball player, big guy. And moments like that, we were so intent on getting our stories that the personal danger became secondary. I remember it being vivid in my mind at the time. But I also remember that we were willing to risk those things. And when we come back to the office, we felt so appreciated, so nurtured. And it was very gratifying to pick up the paper in the morning and see what you had done and to see this ongoing story develop in our community. And I think that we're a better community, not so much for the work we did, but for the fact that we followed the law, that what we did was right, and that ultimately we've ended up with a much better school system. We have one of the best public school systems in the country. We have a unified school system. And I think we should be really proud of that. And it came at great cost, but it came because a lot of people had a lot of determination. One last thought, and then I'll let you get on your way. I want to speak in favor of affirmative action because it's such a maligned topic. Again, I believe that's it's our modern-day racism coming through. But I've seen affirmative action work over and over and over again in outside the newspaper as well as in. I want to give you my favorite example. In 1974, we had some openings on the editorial page. Van Cabot, who was the editor of the Times page, was determined that we would have women and minorities. He went out and hired Carolyn Gatz, who was a Times reporter, and Jill Keeney, who's still on our staff, who was at that time writing editorials for WHAS. And then he found a woman named Jacqueline Thomas, who was with the Chicago Sun-Times and had been to Columbia and Briarcliff and Harvard, too, I believe. I can't remember what her Harvard degree was. She had, you know, sterling academic background from a very affluent family in Chicago. Her father was a major urban planner up there. She's African-American. She came to the staff, and so help me God, I heard over and over again from people, well, they had to hire her because she's black, or whatever. She was the most eminently qualified recruit I've ever seen here. She left here and went on to become a distinguished editor at the Detroit Free Press. She ran the Detroit News Washington Bureau. She's now the editorial page editor at the Baltimore Sun, which is a very important job. She's still one of my best friends, but what I realize is that she wouldn't have gotten that job, probably, if the old system had been allowed to continue. Not that Van wouldn't have wanted to do it, not that she might not have wanted to come here, but the urgency that we had in those days, because we wanted to integrate, and we wanted to have women on the staff, made it not just something that we could do or that, you know, would be a nice thing to do, but it was something that people felt committed to do, and it made us a better institution because of it. And what sickens me today is that so many people say, oh, we've gone through all that, now we don't have to do that anymore. Well, of course we have to do it. I was already getting gray hair when she came here, and I'm only 50 years old now. It was only the day before yesterday when the people who, even today, or some of them are, you know, they're joining the Republican Party and so forth, and advocating various forms of discrimination in different ways, I think. I just don't think that we've come far enough to ignore all those things. I believe in affirmative action. I believe in quotas even. And I guess I'm somewhat different from my colleagues on that. This paper's never embraced quotas, but there are situations where I think that it is the only solution that will cause true and lasting institutional reform. And that's what we've got to have. And I believe that what we're seeing in Washington right now is a temporary reaction to what was a progression over the last 8 years. And I'm hopeful. I mean, you look at the demographics, and we're not going back to the 70s. There's no way that's going to happen. But I think that a lot of people are in for some very hard times if they don't understand what's happening and embrace it rather than continue to fight it.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.